You know that with all my intimacy with Maggie after a whole month's trial I could make nothing of them? Therefore they are a great mystery. Considering their close relations, and that Margaret clearly gave Cain every demonstration of her powers, it is inconceivable that a trained medical man would have to admit after a month that he could make nothing of it, if it were indeed a mere cracking of a joint. One can find no evidence for fraud in these letters, but one does find ample proof that these two young girls, Margaret and Kate, had not the least idea of the religious implications involved in these powers, or of the grave responsibilities of mediumship, and that they misused their gift in the direction of giving worldly advice, receiving promiscuous sitters, and answering comic or frivolous questions. If in such circumstances both their powers and their character were to deteriorate, it would not surprise any experienced spiritualist. They deserved no better, though their age and ignorance furnished an excuse. To realize their position, one has to remember that they were little more than children, poorly educated, and quite ignorant of the philosophy of the subject. When a man like Dr. Cain assured Margaret that it was very wrong, he was only saying what was dinned into her ears from every quarter, including half the pulpits of New York. Probably she had an uneasy feeling that it was wrong, without in the least knowing why, and this may account for the fact that she does not seem to remonstrate with him for his suspicions. Indeed, we may admit that O. Fond Cain was right, and that the proceedings were in some ways unjustifiable. At that time they were very unvenal themselves, and had they used their gift, as D.D. Holm used his, with no relation to worldly things, and for the purpose only of proving immortality and consoling the afflicted, then, indeed, they would have been above criticism. He was wrong in doubting their gift, but right in looking askance at some examples of their use of it. In some ways Cain's position is hopelessly illogical. He was on most intimate and affectionate terms with the mother and the two girls, although if words have any meaning he thought them to be swindlers living on the credulity of the public. "Kiss Katie for me," he says, and he continually sends love to the mother. Already, young as they were, he had a glimpse of the alcoholic danger to which they were exposed by late hours and promiscuous company. "Tell Katie to drink no champagne, and do you follow the same advice?" said he. It was sound counsel, and it would have been well for themselves and for the movement if they had both followed it, but again we must remember their inexperienced youth and the constant temptations. Cain was a curious blend of the hero and the prig. Spirit-trapping, unfortified by any of the religious or scientific sanctions which came later, was a low-down thing, a superstition of the illiterate, and was he, a man of repute, to marry a spirit-trapper? He vacillated over it in an extraordinary way, beginning a letter with claims to be her brother, and ending by reminding her of the warmth of his kisses. "Now that you have given me your heart, I will be a brother to you," he says. He had a vein of real superstition running through him which was far below the credulity which he ascribed to others. He frequently alludes to the fact that by raising his right hand he had powers of divination and that he had learned it from a conjurer in the Indies. Occasionally he is a snob as well as a prig. "At the very dinner table of the president I thought of you, and again, you could never lift yourself up to my thoughts and my objects. I could never bring myself down to yours." As a matter of fact, the few extracts given from her letters show an intelligent and sympathetic mind. On at least one occasion we find Cain suggesting deceit to her, and she combating the idea. There are four fixed points which can be established by the letters: 1. That Cain thought in a vague way that there was trickery; 2. That in the years of their close intimacy she never admitted it; 3. That he could not even suggest in what the trickery lay; 4. That she did use her powers in a way which serious spiritualists would deplore. She really knew no more of the nature of these forces than those around her did. The editor says, she had always averred that she never fully believed the rappings to be the work of spirits, but imagined some occult laws of nature were concerned. This was her attitude later in life, for on her professional card she printed that people must judge the nature of the powers for themselves. It is natural that those who speak of the danger of mediumship, and especially of physical mediumship, should point to the Fox sisters as an example. But their case must not be exaggerated. In the year 1871, after more than 20 years of this exhausting work, we find them still receiving the enthusiastic support and admiration of many leading men and women of the day. It was only after 40 years of public service that adverse conditions were manifested in their lives, and therefore, without in any way glossing over what is evil, we can fairly claim that their record hardly justifies those who allude to mediumship as a soul-destroying profession. It was in this year 1871 that Kate Fox's visit to England was brought about through the generosity of Mr. Charles F. Livermore, a prominent banker of New York, in gratitude for the consolation he had received from her wonderful powers, and to advance the cause of spiritualism. He provided for all her needs, and thus removed any necessity for her to give professional sittings. He also arranged for her to be accompanied by a congenial woman companion. In a letter, The Spiritual Magazine, 1871, pages 525-6, to Mr. Benjamin Coleman, a well-known worker in the spiritualist movement, Mr. Livermore says, "Miss Fox, taken all in all, is no doubt the most wonderful living medium. Her character is irreproachable and pure. I have received so much through her powers of mediumship during the past 10 years, which is solacing, instructive and astounding, that I feel greatly indebted to her, and desire to have her taken good care of while absent from her home and friends." His further remarks have some bearing possibly on the later sad events of her life. "That you may the more thoroughly understand her idiosyncrasies, permit me to explain that she is sensitive of the highest order and of childlike simplicity. She feels keenly the atmospheres of everyone with whom she is brought in contact, and to that degree that at times she becomes exceedingly nervous and apparently capricious. For this reason I have advised her not to sit in dark SA till the copyright answers, that she may avoid the irritation arising from the suspicion of skeptics, mere curiosity mongers, and lovers of the marvelous. The perfection of the manifestations to be obtained through her depends upon her surroundings, and in proportion as she is in rapport or sympathy with you does she seem receptive of spiritual power. The communications through her are very remarkable, and have come to me frequently from my wife, Estelle, in perfect idiomatic French, and sometimes in Spanish and Italian, whilst she herself is not acquainted with any of these languages. You will understand all this, but these explanations may be necessary for others. As I have said, she will not give SA tilde copyright answers as a professional medium, but I hope she will do all the good she can in furtherance of the great truth, in a quiet way, while she remains in England." Mr. Coleman, who had a sitting with her in New York, says that he received one of the most striking evidences of spirit identity that had ever occurred to him in his experience of 17 years. Mr. Cromwell F. Varley, the electrician who laid the Atlantic cable, in his evidence before the London Dialectical Society in 1869, spoke of interesting electrical experiments he made with this medium. The visit of Kate Fox to England was evidently regarded as a mission, for we find Mr. Coleman advising her to choose only those sitters who are not afraid to have their names published in confirmation of the facts they have witnessed. This course seems to have been adopted to some extent, for there is preserved a fair amount of testimony to her powers from, among others, Professor William Crookes, Mr. S. C. Hall, Mr. W. H. Harrison, editor of The Spiritualist, Miss Rosamond Dale Owen, who afterwards married Lawrence Oliphant, and the Reverend John Page Hopps. The newcomer began to hold sittings soon after her arrival. At one of the first of these, on November 24, 1871, a representative of the Times was present, and he published a detailed account of the SA tilde copyright dance, which was held jointly with D.D. Holm, a close friend of the medium. This appeared in an article entitled Spiritualism and Science, occupying 3½ columns of leading type. The Times commissioner speaks of Miss Fox taking him to the door of the room and inviting him to stand by her and to hold her hands, which he did, when loud thumps seemed to come from the panels, as if done with the fist. These were repeated at our request any number of times. He mentioned that he tried every test that he could think of, that Miss Fox and Mr. Home gave every opportunity for examination, and that their feet and hands were held. In the course of a leading article on the above report and the correspondence that came from it, The Times, January 6, 1873, declared that there was no case for scientific inquiry. Many sensible readers, we fear, will think we owe them an apology for opening our columns to a controversy on such a subject as spiritualism and thus treating as an open or debatable question what should rather be dismissed at once as either an imposture or a delusion. But even an imposture may call for unmasking, and popular delusions, however absurd, are often too important to be neglected by the wiser portion of mankind. Is there, in reality, anything, as lawyers would say, to go to a jury with? Well, on the one hand, we have abundance of alleged experience which can hardly be called evidence, and a few depositions of a more notable and impressive character. On the other hand, we have many accounts of convicted impostors, and many authentic reports of precisely such disappointments or discoveries as we should be led to expect. On December 14, 1872, Miss Fox married Mr. H. D. Jenkin, a London barrister at law, author of a compendium of modern Roman law, etc., and honorary general secretary of the Association for the Reform and Codification of the Law of Nations. He was one of the earliest spiritualists in England. The Spiritualist, in its account of the ceremony, says that the spirit people took part in the proceedings, for at the wedding breakfast loud raps were heard coming from various parts of the room, and the large table on which stood the wedding cake was repeatedly raised from the floor. A contemporary witness states that Mrs. Kate Fox Jenkin, as she came to be known, and her husband were to be met in the early 70s in good social circles in London. Her services were eagerly sought after by investigators. John Page Hopps describes her at this time as a small, thin, very intelligent, but rather simpering little woman, with nice, gentle manners and a quiet enjoyment of her experiments which entirely saved her from the slightest touch of self-importance or affectation of mystery. Her mediumship consisted chiefly of raps, often of great power, spirit lights, direct writing, and the appearance of materialized hands. Full-form materializations, which had been an occasional feature of her sittings in America, were rare with her in England. On a number of occasions objects in the S.A. Tilda Copyright Dance Room were moved by spirit agency, and in some cases brought from another room. It was about this time that Professor William Crookes conducted his inquiries into the medium's powers, and issued that wholehearted report which is dealt with later when Crookes's early connection with spiritualism comes to be discussed. These careful observations show that the rappings constituted only a small part of Kate Fox's psychic powers, and that if they could be adequately explained by normal means they would still leave us amid mysteries. Thus Crookes recounts how, when the only people present besides himself and Miss Fox were his wife and a lady relative, I was holding the medium's two hands in one of mine, while her feet were resting on my feet. Paper was on the table before us, and my disengaged hand was holding a pencil. A luminous hand came down from the upper part of the room, and after hovering near me for a few seconds, took the pencil from my hand, rapidly wrote on a sheet of paper, threw the pencil down, and then rose over our heads, gradually fading into darkness. Many other observers describe similar phenomena with this medium on various occasions. A very extraordinary phase of Mrs. Fox Jensen's mediumship was the production of luminous substances. In the presence of Mrs. MacDougall Gregory, Mr. W. H. Harrison, the editor of a London newspaper, and others, a hand appeared carrying some phosphorescent material, about 4 inches square, with which the floor was struck and a sitter's face touched. The light proved to be cold. Miss Rosamond Dale Owen, in her account of this phenomenon, describes the objects as illumined crystals, and says that she has seen no materialization which gave so realistic a feeling of spirit nearness as did these graceful lights. The author can also corroborate the fact that these lights are usually cold, as on one occasion, with another medium, such a light settled for some seconds upon his face. Miss Owen also speaks of books and small ornaments being carried about, and a heavy musical box, weighing about 25 pounds, being brought from a side table. A peculiarity of this instrument was that it had been out of order for months and could not be used until the unseen forces repaired it and wound it themselves. The Spiritualist, Volume 8, p. 299. Light, 1884, p. 170. Mrs. Jenkins' mediumship was interwoven in the texture of her daily life. Professor Butleroff says that when he paid a morning social call on her and her husband in company with them, Aksakoff, he heard raps upon the floor. Spending an evening at the Jenkins' house, he reports that raps were numerous during tea. Miss Rosamond Dale Owen also refers to the incident of the medium standing in the street at a shop window with two ladies, when raps joined in the conversation, the pavement vibrating under their feet. The raps are described as having been loud enough to attract the attention of passers-by. Mr. Jenkin relates many cases of spontaneous phenomena in their home life. Light, 1884, p. 39. The Spiritualist, 4, p. 138, and 7, p. 66. Light, 1882, pages 439-40. A volume could be filled with details of the essay tilde copyright answers of this medium, but with the exception of one further record we must be content with agreeing with the dictum of Professor Butleroff, of the University of St. Petersburg, who, after investigating her powers in London, wrote in The Spiritualist, February 4, 1876, "From all that I was able to observe in the presence of Mrs. Jenkin, I am forced to come to the conclusion that the phenomena peculiar to that medium are of a strongly objective and convincing nature, and they would, I think, be sufficient for the most pronounced but honest skeptic to cause him to reject ventriloquism, muscular action, and every such artificial explanation of the phenomena." Mr. H.D. Jenkin died in 1881, and his widow was left with two sons. These children showed wonderful mediumship at a very early age, particulars of which will be found in contemporary records. Mr. S.C. Hall, a well-known literary man and a prominent spiritualist, describes a sitting at his house in Kensington on his birthday, May 9, 1882, at which his deceased wife manifested her presence. "Many interesting and touching messages were conveyed to me by the usual writing of Mrs. Jenkin. We were directed to put out the light. Then commenced a series of manifestations such as I have not often seen equaled, and very seldom surpassed. I removed a small handbell from the table and held it in my own hand. I felt a hand take it from me, when it was rung in all parts of the room during at least 5 minutes. I then placed an accordion under the table, whence it was removed, and at a distance of 3 or 4 feet from the table round which we were seated, tunes were played. The accordion was played and the bell was rung in several parts of the room, while two candles were lit on the table. It was not, therefore, what is termed a dark sitting, although occasionally the lights were put out. During all the time Mr. Stack held one of the hands of Mrs. Jenkin and I held the other, each frequently saying, 'I have Mrs. Jenkin's hand in mine.' About 50 flowers of heartsease were placed on a sheet of paper before me. I had received some heartsease flowers from a friend in the morning, but the vase that contained them was not in the sitting room. I sent for it and found it intact. The bouquet had not been in the least disturbed. In what is called direct writing, I found these words written in pencil in a very small hand, on a sheet of paper that lay before me: 'I have brought you my token of love.' At a sitting some days previously, when alone with Mrs. Jenkin, I had received this message: 'On your birthday I will bring you a token of love.'" Mr. Hall adds that he had marked the sheet of paper with his initials, and, as an extra precaution, had torn off one of the corners in such a manner as to ensure recognition. It is evident that Mr. Hall was greatly impressed by what he had seen. He writes, I have witnessed and recorded many wonderful manifestations. I doubt if I have seen any more convincing than this, certainly none more refined, none that gave more conclusive evidence that pure and good and holy spirits alone were communicating. He states that he has consented to become Mrs. Jenkins' banker, presumably for funds for the education of her two boys. In view of what afterwards happened to this gifted medium, there is a sad interest in his concluding words. I feel confidence approaching certainty that, in all respects, she will so act as to increase and not lessen her power as a medium while retaining the friendship and trust of the many who cannot but feel for her a regard in some degree resembling, as arising from the same source, that which the new church accords to Emanuel Swedenborg, and the Methodists render to John Wesley. Assuredly spiritualists owe to this lady a huge debt for the glad tidings she was largely the instrument, selected by Providence, to convey to them. We had given this account in some detail because it shows that the gifts of the medium were at this time of a high and powerful order. A few years earlier, a 2S A tilde copyright dance at her house on December 14, 1873, on the occasion of the first anniversary of her wedding, a spirit message was rapped out, when shadows fall upon you, think of the brighter side. It was a prophetic message, for the end of her life was all shadows. Margaret, Mrs. Fox Kane, had joined her sister Kate in England in 1876, and they remained together for some years until the very painful incident occurred which has now to be discussed. It would appear that a very bitter quarrel broke out between the elder sister Leah, now Mrs. Underhill, and the two younger ones. It is probable that Leah may have heard that there was now a tendency to alcoholism, and may have interfered with more energy than tact. Some spiritualists interfered also, and incurred the fury of the two sisters by some suggestion that Kate's children should be separated from her. Looking round for some weapon or any weapon with which they could injure those whom they so bitterly hated, it seems to have occurred to them or, according to their subsequent statement, to have been suggested to them, with promises of pecuniary reward that if they injured the whole cult by an admission of fraud they would wound Leah and her associates in their most sensitive part. On the top of alcoholic excitement and the frenzy of hatred there was added religious fanaticism, for Margaret had been lectured by some of the leading spirits of the Church of Rome and persuaded, as Home had been also for a short time, that her own powers were evil. She mentions Cardinal Manning as having influenced her mind in this way, but her statements are not to be taken too seriously. At any rate, all these causes combined and reduced her to a state which was perilously near madness. Before leaving London she had written to the New York Herald denouncing the cult, but stating in one sentence that the rappings were the only part of the phenomena that is worthy of notice. On reaching New York, where, according to her own subsequent statement, she was to receive a sum of money for the newspaper sensation which she promised to produce, she broke out into absolute raving against her elder sister. It is a curious psychological study, and equally curious is the mental attitude of the people who could imagine that the assertions of an unbalanced woman, acting not only from motives of hatred but also from, as she herself stated, the hope of pecuniary reward, could upset the critical investigation of a generation of observers. Nonetheless, we have to face the fact that she did actually produce rappings, or enable raps to be produced, at a subsequent meeting in the New York Academy of Music. This might be discounted upon the grounds that in so large a hall any prearranged sound might be attributed to the medium. More important is the evidence of the reporter of the Herald, who had a previous private performance. He describes it thus, I heard first a rapping under the floor near my feet, then under the chair in which I was seated, and again under a table on which I was leaning. She led me to the door and I heard the same sound on the other side of it. Then when she sat down on the piano stool the instrument reverberated more loudly and the tap-tap resounded throughout its hollow structure. This account makes it clear that she had the noises under control, though the reporter must have been more unsophisticated than most pressmen of my acquaintance, if he could believe that sounds varying both in quality and in position all came from some click within the medium's foot. He clearly did not know how the sounds came, and it is the author's opinion that Margaret did not know either. That she really had something which she could exhibit is proved, not only by the experience of the reporter but by that of Mr. Wedgwood, a London spiritualist, to whom she gave a demonstration before she started for America. It is vain, therefore, to contend that there was no basis at all in Margaret's exposure. What that basis was we must endeavor to define. The Margaret Fox Kane sensation was in August and September, 1888, a welcome boon for the enterprising paper which had exploited it. In October Kate came over to join forces with her sister. It should be explained that the real quarrel, so far as is known, was between Kate and Leah, for Leah had endeavored to get Kate's children taken from her on the grounds that the mother's influence was not for good. Therefore, though Kate did not rave, and though she volunteered no exposures in public or private, she was quite at one with her sister in the general plot to down Leo at all costs. She was the one who caused my arrest last spring, she said, and the bringing of the preposterous charge that I was cruel to my children. I don't know why it is she has always been jealous of Maggie and me, I suppose because we could do things in spiritualism that she couldn't. She was present at the Hall of Music meeting on October 21st, when Margaret made her repudiation and produced the raps. She was silent on that occasion, but that silence may be taken as a support of the statements to which she listened. If this were indeed so, and if she spoke as reported to the interviewer, her repentance must have come very rapidly. Upon November 17th, less than a month after the famous meeting, she wrote to a lady in London, Mrs. Cottell, who was the tenant of Carlyle's old house, this remarkable letter from New York, Light, 1888, p. 619, I would have written to you before this but my surprise was so great on my arrival to hear of Maggie's exposure of spiritualism that I had no heart to write to anyone. The manager of the affair engaged the Academy of Music. The very largest place of entertainment in New York City, it was filled to overflowing. They made $1,500 clear. I have often wished I had remained with you, and if I had the means I would now return to get out of all this. I think now I could make money in proving that the knockings are not made with the toes. So many people come to me to ask me about this exposure of Maggie's that I have to deny myself to them. They are hard at work to expose the whole thing if they can, but they certainly cannot. Maggie is giving public exposures in all the large places in America, but I have only seen her once since I arrived. This letter of Kate's points to pecuniary temptation as playing a large part in the transaction. Maggie, however, seems to have soon found that there was little money in it, and could see no profit in telling lies for which she was not paid, and which had only proved that the spiritualistic movement was so firmly established that it was quite unruffled by her treachery. For this or other reasons let us hope with some final twinges of conscience as to the part she had played as she now admitted that she had been telling falsehoods from the lowest motives. The interview was reported in the New York Press, November 20, 1889, about a year after the onslaught. Would to God, she said, in a voice that trembled with intense excitement, that I could undo the injustice I did the cause of spiritualism when, under the strong psychological influence of persons inimical to it, I gave expression to utterances that had no foundation in fact. This retraction and denial has not come about so much from my own sense of what is right as from the silent impulse of the spirits using my organism at the expense of the hostility of the treacherous horde who held out promises of wealth and happiness in return for an attack on spiritualism, and whose hopeful assurances were so deceitful. Long before I spoke to any person on this matter, I was unceasingly reminded by my spirit control what I should do. And at last I have come to the conclusion that it would be useless for me further to thwart their promptings. Has there been no mention of a monetary consideration for this statement? Not the smallest, none whatever. Then financial gain is not the end which you are looking to? Indirectly, yes. You know that even a mortal instrument in the hands of the spirit must have the maintenance of life. This I propose to derive from my lectures. Not one cent has passed to me from any person because I adopted this course. What cause led up to your exposure of the spirit trappings?